session today is House Bill 2092, and ask General Caldwell to come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. And appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. I reference House Bill 2092. We asked for this bill to be drafted up and put into the session in an attempt to solve a problem that doesn't happen very often, but on occasion we found that some of our soldiers who are mobilized for federal active duty, and the way things have been going over the last 5 years, these active duty stints are going between 18 and 24 months. And on a couple of occasions, a parent who is deployed of a child, who shares custody with the child, has a new family with siblings and family members. And the soldier happens to be in Iraq, and all of a sudden he finds out that he or she finds out that the previous spouse is denied access of the new family with the minor child. So this was extremely problematic in the case that I'm speaking of. Specifically, the individual wanted to get emergency leave to come home to resolve the problem, but it was determined by the judge advocates that it won't do you any good, because the minute you leave again, the same thing could happen, because the law doesn't allow you that kind of access. So it was an extremely emotional situation. We ended up finally getting the soldier released from active duty early to come home and work with his particular problem with his former spouse. So this law is designed in hopes of trying to make it an acceptable operation, and of course the courts will have the ultimate decision on who sees who, but at least gives the opportunity to keep these families at least communicating during this period of time, so we don't have 18 or 24 month gaps in relationships, which can be very traumatic at the conclusion of that. So that's the purpose of the bill. Your able administrator has brought up a point about in line 29 and 30 that perhaps we should look at a different situation with respect to other than just the parent. It could be, in some instances, we have soldiers who have plans or child care plans that deal with grandparents or parents, and so this, I think, would be a good fix if legislative council and this committee could work on that. We'd certainly be acceptable to that kind of an amendment. And beyond that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Anybody have a question? Representative Bottomici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, and perhaps it's more of a comment on clarification to make sure. I do appreciate the intent of this bill. I just want to make sure that if we're sending it back to try to clean it up a little bit, the new provision down in the final subsection B that refers back up and allows the service member parent to delegate the powers designated in subsection 1 of this section. But when you go back up to subsection 1, even though those are the powers that are intended to be delegated, there's a 6-month time period in there. And I just want to make sure that the record is clear, and that if there's a way to clean up the bill to make sure that that 6 months does not apply, and rather the time frame that's in the 3B is what we're intending, which is during the time of active duty service plus 30 days. So we don't have any ambiguity about a 6-month time period with that reference back up to section 1. That's a good
question. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I would say that's a great catch. I hadn't got that, so I would certainly endorse that intent, because that does send a bifurcated message to somebody trying to read that, I would say, and that's not good.
Mm-hmm. My reading of that would be that the new spouse that we're trying to protect here, that family would be, that isn't giving away the power. I mean, that would be like the parent, but we'll certainly have LC take a look at that as well to be sure that we get what we want here, and that is that when somebody's serving overseas, that their present spouse would be have the parental rights with that child in a joint custody case.
I think the difference could be, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not able to say that. I think legislative council should be the people make that decision. But it does say in 29, that, or I guess in 25, line 25, except as provided. So maybe that's the catch-all in the escape clause there.
Well, we'll get it straight down.
Certainly is worth looking at.
Yeah. Well, thank you, then, General. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2092. And I also would like to, in case anybody's waiting on House Bill 2134, we are not taking that to work session today. We'll have a brief hearing on it, but that has a lot of work needs to be done, and people need to meet, so we're not going to run that one out. Open a public hearing on and possible work session on House Bill 2131. Called Jan Coleman, Sybil Hebb, and Cynthia. Okay, Cynthia. Yeah, please come up. Ms. Coleman, I believe you might want to start just to give an overview.
Well, actually, it's not my bill.
Okay. Choose among yourselves.
Okay. I'm happy to start and give an overview. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm with the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section. Thank you. And I'm here today to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2131. First, if I may, I want to thank Senator Devlin for his leadership and support in the passage of the authorizing legislation for this address confidentiality program in the 2005 legislative session. This is a brand new program to the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section. As I said, it was established through legislation in the 2005 session, where Oregon joined 19 other states in having an address confidentiality program. The program actually went live January 1st, and we began to accept program participants into the program. We have over 130 trained application assistants in all but one Oregon county, and we are working to remedy that quickly. And we are already accepting. We already have a number of program participants. In a nutshell, I want to explain the address confidentiality program, and the purple handout that came with the written testimony gives you a quick overview of the program. Essentially, it provides a substitute address for victims of domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault who are needing to use a different address than their actual residence in order to interface with public agencies. Unfortunately, we find that people that are looking for their victims will often go to places where they can get access to public record. And so this is an attempt to help enhance the safety of those victims when they need that service. It also provides an opportunity for legal service, so we can accept legal service on behalf of one of the program participants if they are served with some kind of legal papers. And we forward their mail. So that is a very simplified explanation of the program. But as we looked forward to implementing the program and its start January 1st of 2007, we recognized that we needed to convene many partners that would be affected by this legislation and by this program. So in early 2006, we convened an address confidentiality advisory committee made up of people from Oregon Judicial Department, Oregon Law Center, county clerks, Oregon District Attorneys, law enforcement, and the Elections Division, and Department of Motor Vehicles. And so we've been working very closely with them to actually set up the program that became operational just a few weeks ago, create OARs to run the program, and also to work on this legislation that we're putting forth to you today. Essentially, House Bill 2131 adds some clarifying language to the already existing statute. As we began to look at the implementation of the program, we realized that there were some key pieces missing from the original legislation. So if I may, I'll highlight just kind of the major points of this bill. And I want to say, too, that there are several amendments that we are going to need to make to this bill, and we are working with our advisory committee partners very closely on those amendments. First of all, in Section 1 of the bill, there is language that allows for precinct and county information to be exempt from the voter information. We are not sure if we're going to be able to make that change without a significant fiscal impact, and I think my colleague will be talking about that later, but we are still hopeful that we may be able to make that work. So we're at this time going to leave that in, but we'll need to be reviewing it, and there may be an amendment that will affect that section. In Section 3, we offer some clarifying language and also a new piece that offers an additional measure of safety that would require public bodies to adopt a policy to prevent unnecessary disclosure of actual address. And an amendment to that sentence will be changing policy to procedure. But the gist of it is we are asking agencies who will interface with address confidentiality participants to adopt a procedure on how that will work and how they will keep that person's information confidential within their own agency. In Section 4, this bill removes language that allows for disclosure of actual address via a simple request for its official use to the ACP program and adds language that requires a court order signed by a judge for disclosure of actual address of the ACP participant. It also requires the judge make a finding of good cause, and it defines what good cause would be. And it allows DOJ to object to the order to disclose a participant's actual address and request a hearing if we didn't receive prior notice of the request. There's a potential amendment to Section 4 also that will add language that speaks to the need for a judge to consider a victim's safety and possible other precautions that may need to be taken, such as a protective order, after the decision has been made to compel the release of the actual address. In Section 11, this section will add further safeguards to the Department of Motor Vehicles process, and with the proper form and a verification from the Address Confidentiality Program, it will allow the ACP participant to request that DMV use their substitute address when they apply for a driver's license or ID card. And that substitute address, which is a PO box, will show up then on their driver's license, and it will show up in any of the internal systems of the DMV. So that's an important change. And finally, we have a significant friendly amendment that will be that's been proposed by the Oregon Judicial Department that exempts ACP participants from jury lists used by the courts. That's also another way that perpetrators may be able to get a hold of someone's actual address. So we're very happy that they made that suggestion, and we'll be working with them on that amendment. Those are the kind of the highlights of the main parts of the bill.
Question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Barker. If a person has the PO box on their driver's license, okay, and you happen to have your tail light and you get pulled over, I'm sure that's probably flagged within the system, but how is the police officer expected to deal with that?
Representative Barker, I'm Representative Comp. Are you asking about how are they supposed to know where you live? And
well, yes, according to their normal procedures when they pull somebody over to verify that's your car, that's who you are, and all those things.
I will need to check on that, but they will have a driver's license number that
should be flagged.
Right. Okay. But I will definitely check on that and get back to you. We do have members of district attorneys' offices and law enforcement on our committee, and they, I'm sure, will know the answer to that question.
Thank you, because, you know, you don't want to put anybody on any other undue stress and duress if that's taken care of ahead of time.
Thank you.
And along that same line, unless the law has changed, you actually are required to have a true location on your driver's license. I mean, I've seen them when I worked in a rural area where it'd say, you know, fourth mailbox down the house up to gravel road kind of thing. So that is something we'll need to be sure is valid. So when an officer does stop somebody, they don't get in this argument over, you have to tell me where it is, and
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a, I guess, a question and perhaps a concern about the friendly amendment to exempt ACP participants from jury lists, because I strongly believe that serving on a jury is an important civic duty, and I also think that people who are in this program may bring a sort of welcome perspective in serving as jurors. And so I wonder if there might be some way to have the participants be in the jury pool with their post office box or some way. I just don't like to see an entire group of people excluded from the jury list, because I do believe that that's an important role that people play in our community, and I would not want to see these people excluded. So perhaps that can be reconsidered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Barker, Representative Bonamici, that certainly is an important consideration. I should have noted, however, the number of people that we are anticipating participating in this program is very small. It's a safety step that very few people have to make, and it's a very difficult process. Participants essentially have to keep the pool of people that know about where they really live very, very small. They must be extremely diligent about who they release their address to, and so we are anticipating a very slow rollout of this program, maybe 25 participants in the first year, and estimating around 200 participants at any given time. So it's a very small pool of people. We certainly will investigate any other alternatives with our partners at the Oregon Judicial Department to see if there's any way to leave those people in the jury pool.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair? I certainly wouldn't want to suggest anything that would compromise their safety, but I would just like to have a way that they can participate in the jury role. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question in regard to Section 2, and realizing that you're concerned about the fiscal impact, but Section 2.1b, a public body is not responsible for requesting that departments, divisions, affiliates, or other organizational units of the public body or other public bodies use the substitute address, and then C, unless requested by the program participant, and it goes on. Since we're talking about a potential body of approximately 200 participants, is there a way to craft a form from an agency, affiliate, other public body to this affected pool of participants that would suggest this is the information we have in file, and then have the mechanism on that same form to become a participant in the confidentiality program, you return this and put your PO box?
Chair Barker, Representative Flores, that's a good question. The entrance into the address confidentiality program is actually a lengthy process whereby the participant is required to meet with one of the trained application assistants and go through a comprehensive safety planning process. And at the end of that process, then, is when they evaluate together whether the address confidentiality program is a necessary and doable piece of their safety plan. So certainly we've been working with our partners at those public agencies, DMV, DHS, to notify people, potential program participants, about how to get in contact with the ACP program and how to contact an application assistant, but they wouldn't necessarily be able to sign someone up. Those agencies actually have another layer of confidentiality that they've been working on in their system. So we're hoping that the two programs together will help increase safety. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Certainly understand that they have to be screened to become part of the program. But once, as part of the program, if an agency is not required to automatically make that without the request, it would seem that an agency program affiliate, et cetera, would provide a document saying, this is the information we have available for you. And if you would like to have the alternate address used, you would sign and return, because now they are already, according to your process, a part of the program.
Representative Barker, Representative Flores, I think I now understand your question. Yes, we can certainly talk with our partners about giving proactive notice or at least a piece of information to them about, if you are an ACP participant, please double check with us about the address that you have on file with us. As part of that intensive safety planning that the program participant does with the application assistant, they will go over in detail how to request that a public body change their information to the address confidentiality address, and will go over with them extensively which public bodies they need to have interface with and how to change that. But that is a good suggestion. Thank you.
Last follow-up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're talking about a pool of potentially 200 participants statewide, I'm interested then to hear the discussion about the potential financial impact, if it seems to be a matter of due diligence and good business practice for these 200 participants.
Chair Barker, Representative Flores, you're talking about the fiscal impact to all of those public bodies. I don't have that information. I do, however, know that we've been working with those partners, and they have not expressed a concern about a fiscal impact on their agencies that would prevent them from changing someone's address to the address confidentiality PO box as a participant.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Now the last part. Then I guess under your testimony, key points of legislation, Section 1, potential amendment, indicates to ensure the least possible fiscal impact. So the discussion then that's going to be ensuing about that piece is what triggered my question.
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Flores. That specific piece in this bill does have a fiscal impact, that specific piece to the State Elections Division as it is currently written. And so, and we are aware of that, and I think my colleague will testify about that. And we are hoping that we can leave this piece in without a fiscal impact. It may be that it's impossible to do, but we are certainly aware and not wanting to put any undue burden on the Elections Division with this addition.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Council.
Just if I can clarify one point. If this bill is enacted as written, Would a driver's license contain a substitute address or an actual address?
Chair Barker, Committee Council, it would contain the ACP PO box substitute address on the hard driver's license or ID card.
And what about follow-up?
Yes.
And how about the records for the Department of Transportation? Would that contain the substitute address or the actual address?
Chair Barker and Committee Council, yes, it would include the substitute address in the records at the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the purpose of the bill, we all agree, is good in intent, and I'm sure I voted for it last session. And I've looked at it real fast. Could you tell me, how does someone come off the list, or is there some way to review to say the danger's gone away, that they come out of the program?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, yes, there is a way for participants very easily to contact our program and say, I no longer have any need for this program. Please take me off the list.
Excellent.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that, but say, you know, if we are causing an undue burden, or it gets to be larger and larger number of people for the system, is there a system anyway to say, well, you know, you should have aspirin to come off or anything?
Mm-hmm. Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, we don't have anything in place at this time. We will... There is a renewal process. There's a four-year period
okay.
of time.
Okay,
does that answer your question? Yes.
Yes.
And we will always be encouraging the program participants to contact another applicant assistant if they are going to renew for the program in order to reevaluate their safety situation at the time that they renew.
Ms. Hibb.
Actually, thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'll defer to the to Ms. Chapman, and I'm mostly here to offer my support of the program and the amendments and to speak for the Oregon Law Center as a participant in the advisory committee that's coming up with these amendments. So I'm happy to answer any questions after the testimony, but thank you.
I will give you some just mostly notes that are...
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Jan Coleman. I am the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks today. I will say my state compatriots here have been very diligent in involving us with the implementation of this program, and we really appreciate that. They've tried to make it as painless as possible on us, and we appreciate their efforts in that. We do have concerns, and that's what I've presented to you there, with what they're proposing in Section 1. We now have a centralized voter registration program throughout the state. That means that all the counties are talking to the same piece of software. We deal with the same vendor, and the Secretary of State's office is utilizing that program too. In order to try to do vote by mail and what we do without a county implementation designation and a precinct designation for people, it's spendy. $385,000 is the estimate.
Wow.
Yeah, and we're all kind of reeling at that, I have to tell you, but it's very far-reaching because most of everything in the voter registration is built around counties and precincts. So that's, you know, any report or anything pretty much touches on this piece. So that's why it's very expensive. And as I was laying in bed this morning, I thought, you know, there's other things you always think of more. Basically, amendment of administrative rules because election materials and so forth would have to be changed. We'd have to get new postal regs and so forth to see. All of our vote-by-mail pieces and so forth have to be passed through the post office. If we don't identify with a county and so forth, I'm not exactly sure how we're going to be able to do that. So there's, you know, there's outlying pieces that the more you think about it, the more it touches on. So this is a big piece for us, and I'm really thinking that if this weren't in the law, that we could probably work with these people, because this does involve a small number of people. It's not so far-reaching that probably maybe we can figure something out within our association and working with the Secretary of State that might make this workable without putting this piece in here. So that was one of that's our biggest concern.
That's a big one.
Yeah, it's a big... And actually, kind of contingent upon it is the very last thing I mentioned, and we want to be sure that in Section 13, the little piece that's being added there, number 3, we want to be sure that that is indeed just referencing voter registration. Actually, I think if this other piece isn't added, probably number 3 doesn't need to be added also.
Are there any questions, Representative Flores?
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. The $385,000 estimate, you say that's 2,000 hours of programming at $175 an hour. Who would you attribute the $175 per hour rate?
Actually, that the figure was given to me from the Secretary of State's office because they talked to the vendor who has created the program. And so those are the programming vendors, and it's probably a combination of more than one person working on it for that time. That's probably how they came up with $175 is my guess, because you would have to put more than one programmer on this at one time. Sabre Corporation is the Saber Corporation is the vendor for the Oregon Centralized Voter Registration.
Follow up, please.
Having seen some recent indication of the dollar amount charged by our attorneys within the Department of Justice, it seems like they should be going into programming.
Right.
Any further questions? Well, thank you. And this, obviously, we will not go to work session. You have so many amendments coming up, and I hope everybody can work together. We certainly need to try to reduce the fiscal impact. I think everybody's in an agreement. We need to protect the women involved, primarily women involved in these programs. And I've seen so many times when a restraining order was nothing more than a piece of paper that the guy walked right through. And we've all seen it in the newspaper if we haven't seen it in person. So this is a great program to help protect vulnerable people, and we want to see that that's done. That being said, we'll close the public hearing. And please, if all the groups can work together and get us back in a minute, we'll get that out as quickly as we can.
Thank you.
I hope that contract was competitively bid.
It's going
to be changed. Well, you might stir the hornet's nest.
Okay. Open up. Public hearing on House Bill 2134, and as I said earlier, we're not going to work this. There appears to be the need for a lot of amendments, and so I would ask that you keep your remarks brief, and then we'll ask that the groups get together, because we don't need to adjust too much at the windmills if the windmills aren't going to be there next time we meet. So Ms. Meyer and Ms. Christensen, would you want to come up first? I'm sorry. Can I have Michael Slauson and Tim Slywester first, Department of Justice? We'll have to give you something to joust at.
Thank you, Chair Barker. We do have prepared testimony. Good morning, Chairman Barker and members of the committee. I'm Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice, and we are Michael Slauson and Katie Suver. Michael Slauson, also from the Department of Justice. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Katie Suver from the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
And we're here on House Bill 2134. We have rather extensive written testimony that we have provided. The essential purpose of this bill is to, in some respects, clarify and fix some minor problems in the current wiretap and statutes that allow for the interception of oral communications, wiretaps, body wires, that sort of thing. And there's a couple of significant changes that we're proposing. They sound significant, but I think in actuality they will probably not be applied that often, but in the situations they will apply, they will be significant. And I want to direct the committee's attention to those. I won't go through section by section. That is done in the written testimony. But the ones I want to draw the committee's attention to in particular appear at section 2. Which will add a new subsection 7B and a new subsection 8. In the circumstance in which a police officer wants to do an undercover investigation and maybe use an undercover officer or a third party to go into a situation, this is, for example, is done in undercover drug buys where you will use a confidential reliable informant or a police undercover agent who will go into a drug house to make a purchase. Current law says that the person can wear a body wire without getting a prior court order. Now, what this particular provision will do is expand that slightly in the case of certain types of investigations, and will allow outside the context of a drug purchase a police officer to have the undercover officer or confidential reliable informant or somebody else to wear a body wire for the purpose of personal protection. And that's what the new 7B would be. And if the officer has reasonable grounds to believe that there is actually a danger to the person going into that situation, they could wear a body wire for the purpose of protecting that person. Any evidence that will be that is obtained thereby will, as explained later in the bill, will not be admissible unless there actually is a crime of violence that occurs, in which case, in prosecuting that crime of violence, the intercepted communication may be used. We don't anticipate that's going to be used often, but in those situations in which it is necessary, it will be helpful. The new subsection 8 is a rather significant change in current law. Currently, if a police officer is involved in a face-to-face conversation with a suspect or a citizen, and the officer wants to record that or transmit it, the officer has to fully disclose to the other person that the conversation is being recorded. In the usual case, that presents no problem. It does present a problem, however, in some circumstances where officers are called into volatile situations, a domestic violence situation or something like that, where people are coming in, there's a lot of things going on, and it may be difficult for the officer in that situation to advise everybody at all times that the conversation is being intercepted. You also have the situation come up where you're talking with one person and somebody else comes into the conversation, another person comes into the conversation, and you end up with that person not being advised that it's being recorded. It seemed to us, and I think this is the way it is done in some states, you just establish a blanket rule that whenever a police officer is in uniform displaying a badge or otherwise on official duty, and that is known to the citizen to whom he's talking to, the officer simply can record the conversation without advising the citizen. And that way everybody knows that whenever you're talking to a police officer, it's possible that you may be recorded. And that has the advantage, of course, is whenever you have a recording, you have the best evidence of what the conversation was because it actually is recorded. And that will also encourage police officers, as I think we all would want, to audio record as many of these conversations as possible to make a complete and fair record. The other significant change that we propose is in Section 3. This is the section that governs the suppression remedy for any violations of the Interception of Communications Act. Right now, the exclusionary rule that is set forth in that statute, 133.735, is rather draconian. You violate it, it doesn't come in for any purpose, and that sometimes creates a problem. And what we propose here is setting out a variety of exceptions to the suppression remedy. Some of these exceptions have already been kind of developed in the case law, and we thought, well, we should put those in black and white in the statute. For example, one of the rules is that if a conversation is intercepted unlawfully through a recording device or a transmitter, the conversation, the intercepted communication has to be suppressed, but anybody who was a party to that conversation still can testify about it. And so that is, the suppression of the tape itself doesn't require every other participant to be able to testify. And so that, this subsection 3A merely codifies that. And I think some of the other ones that I think are significant here is that if you have a situation where the officer reasonably believes at the time that he does the interception that the interception is lawful, and it turns out that a court later says, no, you misinterpreted the law, this is what the law is, the court still can allow the evidence to be admitted because the officer reasonably believed at the time, and I think that, I'm sorry, that's under 3C, big capital B. It would be the circumstances demonstrating the officer making the interception reasonably believed at the time the interception was lawful. And so that creates a, sort of a good faith exception to the suppression remedy that created by the statute. The big C under that one is where the defendant himself was, this is a criminal prosecution, and we are offering the evidence of a intercepted communication, but the defendant himself was not a participant to that communication. And, you know, from our view, if the defendant was not himself not a participant to it, then the interception, although it may have been lawful as to somebody else, was not unlawful as to him, and hence should not be suppressed as to his prosecution. And the other one that I think is important is Big D, where the evidence is offered to impeach a witness whom the court determines to have made materially false testimony during trial. And so if you have a situation where the court, there's an unlawful interception, and the court prior to trial says that particular interception, that intercepted conversation will not be admissible at court in trial. And so one of the participants to that conversation then uses that by getting up on the stand and says something that's materially false about what happened. And I think in that situation, it's only fair for the state to be able to use the intercepted communication then to show that this person is lying on the stand. And so it's a fairly narrow exception, and it's solely for the purpose of trying to make the record speak the truth. Those are basically, I think, the major points of the proposed legislation. If members of the committee have specific questions, I would be happy to answer them, or one of my colleagues will. Was there anything you want to say in addition, Michael?
This is Michael Slauson from the Department of Justice, Chair Barker, members of the committee. You know, I'm just here to answer any questions you might have about the bill.
Okay. Are there any questions so far? No questions.
Thank you.
Just for the record, Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and Mark Landauer, City of Portland Government Relations, have submitted written testimony on this bill. Ms. Meyer, Ms. Christensen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I can't tell you how much I welcome the fact that there will be an opportunity to meet with the Department of Justice with an experienced attorney from OCDLA who knows this very special area of the law. I was speaking with that attorney a bit earlier with respect to this proposed legislation, and OCDLA indeed has some very strong concerns about the provisions, and many of them are related to the items that Mr. Sylvester did testify to. So I welcome the opportunity to have a meeting. Also, I welcome the opportunity to have further public hearings on this matter where I can have an experienced attorney available. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and we too welcome the opportunity as we have very significant concerns. If the committee will indulge me, I don't want to go through the details of the bill because we are going to work on those, but I thought I'd quote from Olmstead versus the United States 1928 decision, the first wiretapping case, and Justice Brandeis's statements, because it really cuts to the heart of where we start from this conversation. And for those who went to law school, this reminds us of the language they used back then, but for those who didn't, it's quite the way they write opinions back then is a little bit different than how we write them now. He wrote, "When the Fourth and Fifth Amendments were adopted, force and violence were then the only means known to man by which a government could directly affect self-incrimination. It could compel the individual to testify, a compulsion effected, if need be, by torture. It could secure possession of his papers and other articles incident to his private life, a seizure effected, if need be, by breaking an entry. The progress of science in furnishing the government with means of espionage is not likely to stop with wiretapping. ways may someday be developed by which the government, without removing papers from secret drawers, can reproduce them in court, and by which it will be enabled to expose a jury to the most intimate occurrences of the home. The makers of our Constitution undertook to secure conditions favorable to the pursuit of happiness. They recognize the significance of man's spiritual nature, of his feelings, and of his intellect. They knew that only a part of the pain, pleasure, and satisfactions of life are to be found in material things. They sought to protect Americans in their beliefs, their thoughts, their emotions, and their sensations. They conferred, as against the government, the right to be let alone, the most comprehensive of rights, and the most valued by civilized men. So with that thought, we will work with the department, but we do have significant concerns. Thank you.
All right, and one other thing I would like to be considered in those debates is on the tape recordings. If people are tape recording all the time, what happens to those tapes? How long do they need to be kept? And I mean, I'm foreseeing the question of, did you tape record the conversation, officer? No, why not? And you know, those kind of things. And if they did, where is the tape? And so, and then that, of course, if they do have to maintain those safes, that's a huge issue for financial and storage space and everything else. So, any questions from the committee? I want to thank you, everybody, for coming in this morning and giving the brief testimony on this, and I hope to see a better product when we come back so we can get it out. And I'll remind everybody once again, we're shooting for a June 30th end of sessions, and we're already these things are starting to back up. We need to really fly them out.
Chair,
yes,
June 29th.
Thank you. Even be faster. But anyway, so we do want to get these things done, and I've spoken with Chairman McPherson. He really wants to get things rolling because we know, especially in this committee, we're going to be really loaded down, and the wave's coming. We're going to be really inundated soon, and we're going to be meeting again at 8 a.m. shortly to help accommodate all this stuff coming through.
Mr. Chair, we do want you to leave by June 29th. Thank you.
Close the public hearing on 2134.